We're taking time this week to consider the many challenges facing Detroit. One is a shrinking population. Detroit has fewer than half the people it had at its peak. That's left vast stretches of deserted buildings and lots of empty land. Some community groups say their city should be reconfigured in an entirely new way. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports.
Even when Detroit was a city of nearly 2 million people, it was always a sprawling one. You could fit Boston, San Francisco, and Manhattan within Detroit's city limits and still have room left over. Now, there's likely about 800,000 people scattered through all of that space. 35% of it is just vacant. You wouldn't know that if you were just looking at this scene in northwest Detroit on a recent beautiful spring day. Children and parents crowd a shiny new playground in a neighborhood of broad, tree-lined streets with beautiful brick homes built in the 1920s and 30s. This is the Grandmont-Rosedale area, one of Detroit's most vibrant, stable communities.
Even though we've been a strong neighborhood, it's going to still take effort to keep it that way.
Tom Gadaris is executive director of the Grandmont-Rosedale Development Corporation. Driving the streets, he slows down as he approaches one of the very few vacant land parcels in the neighborhood.
We're going to put a tree nursery here. The intention was to build some more houses there. So we're finding, you know, other productive uses for the land already on just a small scale.
Gadaris and other Detroit community leaders hope to reproduce similar efforts on a much larger scale. They've come up with what they call a strategic revitalization framework for the entire city. The framework agrees with the basic downsizing premise. The city must adjust to a shrinking population and concentrate services in dense neighborhoods. But it also insists that every part of the city be in some way repurposed, even if it's consciously turned back over to nature. Stronger areas like Grandmont-Rosedale would remain traditional residential neighborhoods, but some blighted areas would undergo radical transformation.
And what you're going to start to see, this is still a little bit industrial, but look at right here. I mean, this is just a crime that this is allowed to happen.
Maggie DeSantis is president of the Warren Connor Development Coalition on Detroit's east side, and the crime she's talking about is a bunch of tires scattered in the street. This part of the city is littered with abandoned factories, trash-filled vacant lots, and burned-out homes. In some areas, the vacancy rate approaches 80%. Still, you can turn a corner and come upon a nice-looking residential neighborhood seemingly out of nowhere. But DeSantis says it's often a 2 or 3 square block island in a sea of blight.
You'll get a few blocks in a row of, you know, good dense housing, and then you'll see 2 or 3 blocks that have just collapsed. And, you know, some crack house took over, some drug dealers took over, people started getting afraid and they left.
DeSantis says the idea is to let data drive land use decisions, but she admits that will lead to some close judgment calls. She says the long-term ideal is a Detroit that offers all kinds of living styles, from sprawling natural landscapes to traditional urban centers.
And it either stays that way and it becomes a really unusual city that a lot of people enjoy living in, or it becomes a magnet for more, you know, for people to move back and you repopulate. But if we don't handle now what's going on now, shame on us.
DeSantis says there will inevitably be some resistance to such a radical reconfiguration. But she says it will be less than most people think if residents are offered enough choices and incentives. Detroiter Chelsea Davis agrees. She loves her neighborhood on the city's far east side, but admits it's an oasis in a largely desolate area.
That's scary because you know, when you invite people from other places, you don't want to route them through that way because they're not going to want to come to your home.
Davis argues that the status quo just isn't sustainable anymore.
I think for a lot of people, especially myself, I want to stay. I don't want to move. I don't want to leave the city, but I do want things to change.
Proponents of the revitalization framework insist that drastic level of change is necessary for Detroit's survival. But they're quick to acknowledge that it won't be easy. In fact, it will amount to urban reinvention on a scale that's never been tried in any American city. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Swick in Detroit.
And our series on Detroit continues on All Things Considered this evening with a look at efforts to retrain former auto workers.
All this week, we'll be hearing stories about one of America's most troubled cities, Detroit, and now a broader look. Michigan has the worst unemployment in the country, so it's using a program called No Worker Left Behind to retrain and reinvent its workforce. So far, more than 120,000 people have signed up, but many workers with certificates of completion are still looking for jobs. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
For Karen Alexander, the last 18 months have been full of anxiety and frustration. She's missed mortgage payments, had to get food aid, and even had her utilities shut off for a few very cold days. It all started when she was laid off from her job at an auto supplier, where she'd worked for 32 years.
And it just kept going downhill, 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 until January of this year, when I actually got the approval for school. And then, you know, the sun started to shine again.
The 52-year-old single mom just completed training to become a certified nursing assistant.
I'm an example. I don't care what age you are. You know, I've got it in me still. I'm going to go for it.
Alexander is looking for work now at hospitals and nursing facilities near her home in Warren, Michigan. These jobs are entry-level positions that pay less than half of what she made in the auto industry. And as she scans through a job search website, the results are underwhelming.
You know, you can't give up. If you give up, then, you know, there was no sense in going through all this. I'm doing this for a reason. I set a goal that by the end of June, I would have a job.
One man who certainly has to hope she's right is Andy Levin, Michigan's chief workforce officer. He says the No Worker Left Behind program emphasizes longer-term training in fields deemed in demand.
If you're willing to become any number of jobs in advanced manufacturing, healthcare, renewable energy production, on and on, we will give you up to $10,000 worth of free training at any Michigan community college, university, or other approved training program.
But figuring out which fields truly are in demand has proven an inexact science.
It's a roll of the dice, but, you know, it's the best roll that you have right now.
John Bierbussi is the executive director of Macomb St. Clair Michigan Works in suburban Detroit.
We do get information on what they expect to happen, and we try to align our training to those speculations. But it's speculation.
Even sure things sometimes aren't. Last year, an engineering staffing firm called Talisand saw that there was demand for workers in the piping design field. So the company teamed up with the county and the local community college to create a targeted program. The plan? Train out-of-work automotive designers for jobs mostly in the oil and gas industry. 49 people finished training before Bierbussi says it became clear that jobs hadn't materialized.
The credit crunch kind of caught up with them, too. Some of their expansions and things like that were put on hold because these companies could not get loans.
Gino Tadellini was one of the 49. He thought he'd found the perfect new career when he signed up for the pipeline design program.
Sounded really good to me, and with the new industry, and thought I'd give it a try.
Tadellini was so excited about it, he even recruited some of his former colleagues.
I thought it would be a good move. A year later, no such leads as far as employment, no formal interviews since then.
So far, just 9 of his classmates have gotten jobs in piping design. Several others are back in the auto industry. The rest, more than half, like Gino, are still looking. A state report estimates that only about 40% of laid-off workers who went through No Worker Left Behind training found jobs related to their field of study.
I think our numbers on that are great.
The state's Andy Levin says it's all about context. He points out this is the worst job market in generations.
There definitely are people who go and train to be something very specific and then they are not able to get a job, you know, in that way. But I think in general, a lot of people are sort of moving into whole new careers through this.
He stands by the idea that someone who has gotten training will ultimately be better off. Others involved in worker retraining say they are careful not to overpromise. Jim Jacobs is president of Macomb College, a large community college in the Detroit suburbs.
I mean, there's no illusions that somehow this program will uncover this hidden stream of jobs that exists somewhere in Michigan that no one has ever found before.
John Warner stands out in the Macomb College library. At 60 years old, he has a lot more gray hair than most of the other students. He's in the middle of a 2-year program in information technology.
I'm hoping for the best with getting through school and the economy picking up some and being able to find another job to get into that'll pay a fairly decent salary.
Warner needs this to work out.
It's kind of a tough thing, I think, to figure out here in Michigan exactly what's going to fly and what isn't.
He can only hope that the in-demand field he's training for will be in demand when he's done with school. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
There aren't many alternatives to the big three credit ratings agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's, but NPR's Cindy Rodriguez reports on a startup agency in New York City that wants to offer a different approach.
For more than 30 years, Jules Krull ran an international company that investigates, among other things, financial fraud and corruption for foreign governments and corporations, digging up information on embarrassing problems that can lead to scandal, lawsuits, and ultimately lost revenues was his specialty. Krull sold the company for more than $1 billion. Now, the 68-year-old plans to take his investigative expertise and apply it to creating a credit rating agency.
I saw this as another version of due diligence, that you really look hard at what the underlying facts are, and then you rate them, which is what we've done for years, but in a different context.
Krull says his rating agency won't just rely on arithmetic modeling like the big three were doing. Instead, he says his bond raters will look at the lending terms of the actual mortgages being packaged and do physical inspections of a sampling of properties, the kinds of things he says the current firms fail to do.
There has been virtually no skepticism, virtually no fact-finding. It has been the acceptance of what's presented by the people seeking to raise the money.
The people seeking to raise the money are financial institutions such as Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and others. Whether they misled the credit rating agencies is currently under investigation by New York's Attorney General. While the reputations of credit rating agencies are getting badly damaged, it's investors like pension funds and other institutions that have lost billions of dollars, a fact Krull is keenly aware of.
It's really time for the investment institutions to take charge of their own destiny.
He's been soliciting them and expects pension funds in particular to own up to 40% of his company, giving them substantial power over how ratings are conducted.
They owe it to themselves. They owe it to the people whose money they are managing.
Krull says he'll try to get 20 pension funds to sign on with him by the end of the year. California's Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, wouldn't comment on whether it's interested in Krull, but it did make clear the institution feels duped by credit rating agencies. CalPERS is currently suing Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's, claiming they helped structure three investments that ended up collapsing despite having AAA ratings. Hundreds of millions of dollars were lost. In press reports, Standard & Poor's and Fitch have both called CalPERS' claims baseless and without merit. Lawrence White is an economics professor at New York University's Stern Business School. He's been closely following the failures of the credit rating agencies that stand accused of giving in to financial firms that were threatening to take their business elsewhere if they didn't receive desirable ratings.
The issuers did make those kinds of threats. There was shopping around that was going on, and the rating firms succumbed.
White believes increasing competition among credit rating agencies is key to reforming the current system. And once there are more options, he says the markets will decide who's got the most accurate ratings. Krull plans to release his first ratings in July. Cindy Rodriguez, NPR News, New York.
We're looking this week at Detroit and the many struggles facing that city. The beleaguered U.S. auto industry is showing some signs of life. Ford is gaining market share and GM is slowly paying back the government. Those gains, though, haven't really improved the job market in Detroit. Unemployment in the city ranks among the worst in the nation. So civic leaders are looking to another sector to revive the Motor City, healthcare. As Noah Ofshinsky of member station WDET reports, the city is hoping that industry will bring thousands of new jobs.
A few weeks ago, officials with Detroit's largest health system made an announcement that was as startling as it was welcome, that they intended to sell the nonprofit to an investor-owned company. As part of the deal, Nashville-based Vanguard Health Systems promised to spend more than $800 million, yeah, you heard me right, $800 million on much-needed capital improvements. If the deal goes through, hospital officials say it will be the largest single investment in Detroit ever. For those who are charged with running the Detroit Medical Center and the city itself, the announcement couldn't come soon enough.
Hey, guys. You all right? Hey, Tanya, how are you doing? How are you?
Walking through the ER at Sinai Grace Hospital, President Conrad Mallett's smile is in stark contrast to the maze-like facility he's showing off, which is dark, outdated, and inefficient.
These people have largely been in the hospital probably waiting for a bed at least 3 or 4 hours, and you can see for yourself the lack of privacy that all of these people are experiencing.
Pointing to patients separated by small curtains, Mallett says quality isn't only about nurses, doctors, and technology.
At the end of the day, the privacy that these men and women have a right to expect is provided by curtains, and it's just not the standard of care that people anywhere should experience, and Detroiters absolutely have a right to expect and receive better.
If the deal with Vanguard is approved by state regulators, those curtains will soon be replaced by walls. The company has promised to spend more than $75 million on improvements at Sinai Grace. The Detroit Medical Center, or the DMC as it's called locally, is the city's primary safety net, providing more uncompensated care than any other health system in the state. That commitment comes at a cost. While the DMC has turned a profit for 6 years in a row, officials say the health system's payer mix makes raising money on Wall Street all but impossible. As a result, the facilities are showing their age, and potential patients like Amy Carras look to DMC's competitors for care.
You know, I remember my parents walked in right after, like, the day that he was born, and they looked at the room we were in, and they're like, "Are you kidding me? You have this all to yourself for the whole time that you're here?" And I'm like, "We've stayed in hotel rooms that aren't this big or nice."
Carras is a freelance journalist who lives in the city of Detroit, but chose to have her babies at Beaumont Hospital, one of the DMC's suburban competitors. Nurses call it the Hilton. There are flat-screen TVs, pull-out beds for fathers, and plenty of privacy. This is what the DMC and its aging facilities are up against, and the goal is to lure insured patients like Amy Carras from miles around. DMC officials say they even hope to take on hospitals like the Cleveland Clinic. That vision is met, though, with a healthy dose of skepticism by those who study such deals. Without selling hospitals, turning away needy patients, or cutting services, experts say they don't see how Vanguard will get a good return on its investment. Jill Horwitz is a University of Michigan law professor who studies nonprofit and for-profit hospitals.
Every hospital in the country wants to start one of these centers of excellence or bringing in foreign patients. And it's a pretty tough business to succeed in. And it's unclear to me why this hospital would do better than its competitor hospitals.
But that skepticism doesn't dampen Detroit Mayor Dave Bing's enthusiasm for this deal.
We are elated, to say the least, that somebody from the outside looks at Detroit as a place where they can make an investment and get a return on the investment. I think it will send a message around the country that we as a city are open for business.
There are signs of investment fever. Not long after the DMC made its announcement, rival Henry Ford Health System said it too planned to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in its campus here. The message? Medicine could possibly replace motors as the engine of Detroit. For NPR News, I'm Noah Ovshinsky in Detroit.